guys. I'm fantasy author J.H. Fleming.
And I think that I am fantasy and science fiction author Philip Dreyer Duncan, but it feels like it's been way too long since we've done this, and I don't remember who I am anymore. Welcome back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It also didn't help that we both got sick there for a while.
Yeah.
As far as remembering who we are. Like, I don't even know what day it is. Who am I? What's happening?
I'll just own it. This was not meant to be the first episode of the new year. We were going to do one last week, but yeah, we were both ill and I was just like, nah, we'll just get started again next week. So
I think that was one of the days I still came home and immediately took a nap because, yeah, just feeling really bad.
Yeah, that's the truth of it, guys. I was raring to go. I was ready. I had show notes and everything. I was like, let's do this podcast. And JH was all like, I'm sick. And I was like, whatever. It's not true. I was sick as well. And I was, it didn't take a lot for me to just be like, I looked at her. I felt like garbage. I looked at her and I was like, yeah, we're not doing a podcast. But anyway, we're back now. And we have a super awesome guest that we're super excited about. Our guest tonight won the Writer's Digest Self-Published Ebook Award for YA with her first novel, Mabel, the Lovelorn Dwarf. Her novel was also the finalist for the Aurora Award for Best YA Novel. She has three novels published in that series, and she is also a writing coach. So if you guys need help, you can hire her. Welcome, Sherry Peters, and thank you for nodding that I said your character's name right.
Giving you thumbs up. Hi, Phil. Hey, Jage.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah, our pleasure. We are delighted to talk to you again. It's been far too long. We were talking about this in the messages. It feels like forever since World Fantasy, but it also feels like last week, you know?
Yep. It really does. I don't know where the time has gone. It just feels like every month I wake up and I'm like, how is it the middle of the month already? It's still July.
Right?
Yeah, right. Like, why is it so cold? I'm pretty sure it's still summer.
Why is it snowing outside? I don't understand.
Why are people giving me gifts?
Well, that they can do anytime, really.
I'm always open for gift giving. Gift receiving, at least. Did you have a good holiday?
I did. My niece had a baby on Christmas Eve at 11:56 p.m.
Wow.
Couldn't wait four more minutes.
4 minutes.
But
push it back in.
Oh, rather quick, actually. She is absolutely adorable. She's got like the biggest cheeks ever, and I just want to smush them. And she's just beautiful. And so that was the event of the holidays, really, was just baby being born and getting to see her and my niece, of course, whom I adore and love, and seeing my family and my other niece and her little girl. So yeah, pretty much that was about it.
Well, that's exciting. I was freaking out because JH bought me a Wolverine action figure, but it sounds like you had much bigger events happening.
Well, I mean, for myself personally, I didn't do much. That was, you know, I just stayed on the phone watching the pictures come in, really. So, yeah.
All right. Well, tell us about Mabel the Lovelorn Dwarf and the series.
Oh, Mabel. I adore her. Let me see. I'll start with saying I'll just start with how I started writing her.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was attending Odyssey writing workshop, and Jean Cavellas, who runs Odyssey, she kept talking about how there are no fantasy stories with female dwarfs. Terry Pratchett has a female dwarf character, but really that's about it. And then one of my classmates had written a story involving a very attractive female elf that all the boys were in love with. And Jean said, why is there never one about a male elf that all the girls love? And I said, what would, and then, you know, being a Tolkien fan that I am, I was thinking, you know, Tolkien covers this in Lord of the Rings in the appendices, you know, a third of the dwarf population is female. So what would it be like for them? And what happens if she's in love with the most beautiful elf boy ever? Basically that's how it started. And it kind of grew out of, I was a fan of Bridget Jones's Diary and, you know, the self-help romance books, because what if she's in love but she doesn't recognize, and just, you know, playing on that silliness and having fun with it, and grew out of a flash fiction piece to a few short stories to into a novel into a trilogy. So and really it's playing with the ideas of, well, the thing that I love about fantasy in general is that you can have a social commentary, but have fun with it. And the whole idea of women's appearance and the social pressures and kind of flipping them on their head. So she isn't stout enough. Her beard isn't thick enough. She's, she's going against her family's legacy of mining to go into movies. And she's in love with an elf, which, you know, traditional fantasy trope of dwarves and elves hate each other. And so it's kind of playing on that and she finding herself really in who she is and what she wants, and doing a little axe throwing in the meantime.
Nice.
Oh, and she does get mixed up with the elven mafia as well.
Naturally.
That sounds fun.
Well, and so I guess it worked out because you won some awards. What was that like?
Winning the Writer's Digest was incredible. It was the first time I actually felt validated for my writing. Mm-hmm. Because I self-published, I had gone through about 75 agents and editors, all of which said it wasn't marketable, which may or may not have been true. But sending it off to Writer's Digest for their competition and getting the response that I had won was the first time I felt like a real writer, and that somebody else, not just me, thought it was worth something. Yeah, so that was just amazing. Also, it helped I was in Mexico at the time on a family vacation. And I just like randomly was like, oh, you know, because I knew the announcements were coming out. I was like, oh, I'll just see if I can check. And I checked my email and I just started jumping up and down in love. Like, I won! And then in the lobby, because it was Christmas, so they were decorating and they had these little gnomes all over the little lobby area, Christmas gnomes. So, of course, I have my picture taken with one of them and a little glass of champagne.
Nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny on the validation piece we had on just before Christmas, I think our last guest was Bill Ledbetter.
Mm-hmm.
And he had won... What did he win? A Nebula? He'd won a Nebula, I think. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that, and then we got into the whole conversation about, like, you know, when you start feeling down on yourself or doubting yourself, I'm like, you can just always look at that. You can go point at that award and be like, listen, self, you are wrong. Yep. I am good at this. This is yep. what I'm good at. There's the proof, right?
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Absolutely.
And second place for the Aurora too. That's pretty exciting as well.
Yeah, that was, so I came in second behind, I believe it was Charles DeLint.
Oh, wow.
And I believe I tied with Kelly Armstrong. That was pretty awesome. That was a shocker that I was totally not expecting at all.
Yeah, I was going to say Charles DeLint's one of my favorite authors. Yeah. And speaking just for myself, if I lost to him, I'd be like, yeah, he deserves it. But yeah, I'm glad that, you know, I was a close second.
Yeah.
Yeah, being second place to Charles DeLint is being first place.
It's no great loss.
Right. Yet. Yes. Right. It's like, I still won.
Yeah. I'm still first place.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty cool, too. Yeah. but not nearly as exciting a story, I'm afraid. I just I knew I hadn't won officially, but I hadn't known, I guess usually the day after, no, that night, they usually email the finalists the vote breakdown. And I saw that and I was like, wow, I did so much better than I thought I was going to do.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, so the other thing we wanted to ask you about while we have you on is I don't think we've had anybody else on who's a writing coach. I don't believe. We certainly haven't talked about it if we had, or my memory's gone and, well, the listener's got to deal with it. So do you want to walk us through that? What, you know, what you do as a writing coach and how you help authors and that sort of a thing?
Sure. So my focus really as a coach is on helping writers to break through the writer's block and the self-doubt and imposter syndrome. So I don't usually do a lot of editing, whereas a lot of book coaches will say, oh, you know, I'll help with editing process. I will give some general feedback if you want me to. But just, to, you know, if the story is working, if that scene is working, or, you know, general questions like that. But I see my position as your coach to be more of your cheerleader. Whereas often when you're getting feedback, it can be a little critical and you start to feel bad and like you're terrible. And that's not my job. My job is to help you. And really to help writers get the words on the page so that they can edit them and get them out the door, whether that be to be submitting to agents and editors or self-publishing it. And, you know, finding a way to grow their readership, finding a way to find their place in the writing world. So it's my, so I work with them really to figure out what's stopping them from writing, and how to work around it and how to get their consistent writing practice if that's what they need, and holding them accountable to just, yeah, get the words on the page and out the door.
Interesting. What led you to go down that path? What made you want to do that? Was it just your own self-doubt in the past that you were like, I want to help other people overcome this?
Yeah. So I was studying at Seton Hill University and doing my master's in writing popular fiction. We had to submit pages every month. And at the end of it, you have a complete novel. And while I was there, two things happened. I got to interview a very famous author for my local Writers Guild newsletter. And I asked if he had any advice for fantasy authors. And I said, you know, that I'd gone to Odyssey. And he said, oh, those kind of workshops are just cults of personalities. Don't mean anything. They'll never help you with your publishing career. And I left thinking, wow, so everything I did was for nothing. And then another famous author came to town to do a reading. And I asked for advice about finding an agent. And he said, oh, you're from Winnipeg. Don't bother trying to get a New York agent. You will never get one. You should try at best to try to find one in Toronto. And at that point in time, there were no Canadian agents representing fantasy and science fiction.
Oh, wow.
And again, I thought, okay, great. So it's all for nothing. And I went into the deepest pit of self-doubt and writer's block. And yet I had to put pages together to send. I mean, that was my saving grace. And then through work, I started coming up with ways to try to figure out, you know, figuring out that it was my inner saboteur that was really stopping me, because it's not a critic. It's not a censor. You know, sometimes those have their place, but it was a saboteur because it just didn't want me to succeed at anything. And it was doing everything it could to stop me. And then I ended up taking life coach training through work. And so much of what I was learning in my life coach training, I'd already started doing with my writing and helping myself as a writer. And I thought, well, why not put the two together? Because my main group of people that I associate with are writers. So why not put the two together and help other writers like myself so that they don't have to go through that either.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting concept. And that's not what I would have thought, right? Because I've never worked with a writing coach or really even talked with anybody about it, I don't think. Again, memory. But that's a very interesting concept of marrying those two ideas together.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I know so much, like, the life coach, I get such a bad reputation because of people like Dr. Phil and the, but it really is. And the training I took was quite extensive. It was over 3 years every Wednesday. And it was, it's what we call solution focused life coach mm-hmm. training, because there's different kinds. And so it's really about figuring out what your goal is and how you're going to get it. So it's not going into therapy and parts of your past. I mean, some of that might come up, but it's really about, okay, so that's your roadblock. What are you going to do to overcome it? And how committed are you going to be? Yeah.
I know life coaching gets a bad rep, but I mean, anything that helps somebody straighten out their own brain and approach their goals and achieve them, I think is a win, right? Now, I'm sure there are, you know, I imagine with life coaching, part of the reason it gets a bad rep is because when it sort of came on the scene, it was like, what is this? And then there were probably a lot of charlatans taking advantage of it. But I'd imagine by now that's probably weeded itself out mostly, you know?
A fair bit. Although, again, on television, they're mostly terrible. Or even when they're represented in books, you know, I was reading a series of cozy mysteries featuring a life coach who in the Hamptons, she has to solve mysteries, which isn't related to her coaching, but it's terrible. She's not doing it right. She's doing it all wrong. She shouldn't be doing that.
Well, and I imagine for some people, like I get where, you know, people, you know, make jokes about the life coaching thing or whatever, but what maybe people don't take into consideration is some people don't have anyone positive around to encourage them, right? Or they don't have a mentor. They don't have somebody who can say, listen, you can achieve your goals. This is how we're going to do it. Here's step one, here's step two.
Yeah.
And I think if somebody doesn't have that available to them, then let's train. We're about to pause for train ad. I will finish that thought real quick. If somebody doesn't have someone else, then they could do a lot worse than to hire somebody to help them through that, you know? All right. Super happy, exciting first train ad of the year. Woohoo!
Are you experiencing hairy feet, an adventurous itch, or butt pain? Then you should buy a copy of J.H. Fleming's latest novel, Music the Gathering, A Most Unusual Assassin. What does a fantasy novel have to do with those conditions, you ask? Nothing. But it's so damn good you'll forget all about your furry little hobbit feet. Don't wait. Buy it now and tell your doctor how awesome it is. Side effects may include magical adventure, hours of introverted fun, great characters, tears of joy, and death. Buy it now.
Well, I know that you, dear listener, just heard an awesome train ad, I'm pretty sure. But while we were on break, we were talking about people getting hacked up and put into suitcases. So we're bringing the energy. Let's jump from people hacked up in suitcases to Sherry is a writing coach. And I believe you've written a few books on writing as well, right?
I have. I'm just going to plug the book that I'm writing now is about a life coach to serial killers.
Oh, that's funny.
Maybe it's appropriate. But yes, I have written a couple of books. One is Silencing Your Inner Saboteur, and it covers differently where the, what is the saboteur, where it comes from, and how essentially to shut it up. I know that the listeners can't see it, but Phil and JH can see it, that I have this beautiful picture behind me. That is a picture done by Andy Serkis, who played Gollum in Lord of the Rings. And it is a picture he did, portrait he did of Gollum being captured by the soldiers of Gondor. And that is my inner saboteur being stopped by the soldiers to shut him up. So It's one of the analogies I use in the book. And following up on that, I did Blueprint for Writing Success, which covers some of the same things, but also talks about the four stages of writing, from dreaming big to putting the ideas on the page to editing and the conflicts that come up with that. And then, of course, going forward and getting them out the door.
All right. Very cool. Okay. One more for you. Oh, wait, no, I lied. Two more for you, because I have a feeling that JH probably wants to talk to you about something non-book related. Am I right, JH?
Do you have a non-book related? Are you just waiting for me to talk now?
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks like Phil has a note about you used to live in Northern Ireland.
I did. So. I did.
I have so many questions.
Okay.
But I guess what from that, like, would you like to share? Like, how did you get there? What was the circumstances? What was it like?
Oh, okay. So this is going to be a triple episode, because we're just going to talk about Northern Ireland.
Oh no, what have I done? We have one Irish listener. There is one Irish listener out there. And they're the only one who's going to love this episode.
Oh, no, you're all going to love it. No, okay, so I was obsessed with learning about Irish history, and fell in love in particular with Northern Ireland and the conflict. And I had gone a couple of times. I went in, well, we won't age myself that much, but so I went once, and it was just on vacation. It was to get it out of the system. And I had a fabulous time. I bought like a million books at the Queen's University in Belfast bookstore, all about the history of the conflict from all different sides. And it was amazing, but it just felt, there was one moment where I came out of a cultural shop, souvenir shop in West Belfast, and there was just a brief moment where I was like, oh, I'm home. And I'm like, but no, I have no Irish blood in me whatsoever. This is not my home. I was like, but no, this is my home. I just felt like I totally belonged there. And so then it became a search on how to get back there. I went with a church organization to work in a holiday children's holiday program that worked with kids from both sides in Northern Ireland, just outside of Belfast, taking them to a little holiday place and giving them a week break, basically. And it was so much fun. But it was only for 3 weeks. And so how else was I going to get back? I had to find a way. I had applied for a job once at the University of Ulster, and I even got a phone interview. And I could hear myself totally bombing the interview. It was like an out-of-body experience. I was saying all the wrong things. And I was like, fix it, fix it. And then multiple other times I tried to get there. And then former colleague of mine was working with one of my church organizations, conference organizations. And they had a one-year volunteer position that came open that I was a fit for. And I said, you better not be messing with me. and it was at, so I was working at Wave Trauma Center. Shout out to the amazing people there, Tracy Sherlow, Alan McBride, Sandra Peak, especially, who are still there. And it's a cross-community organization that offers support to victims of the Troubles, from both sides. So they offer therapy, they offer art therapy, physiotherapy, they offer all kinds of classes on trauma, and for university students and working with people with trauma. We worked with the families of the disappeared in terms of supporting them to petition the government, Irish and British, and the Northern Ireland government when it was in session at Stormont. It kept getting devolved to find their loved ones, because they had only recently been starting to be found. Now, most of them have been found, but there are still some that have not been found. You know, 30 years later, they're still looking for their loved ones who were taken from them and never being really told what happened to them. And so we worked with them. Essentially, I was a receptionist. So I welcomed people, got them a cup of tea. The ladies who volunteered there with me were people who, members of WAVE, so they took made use of their services. They were the most amazing people, and they would always bring me wee buns, which for us would be cakes and cookies. And they're like, well, that will do you for your tea, for my supper. And it was just one of the things, but their government funding was being cut because the EU was expanding. And so James Nesbitt is one of their patrons and the actor. And so someone he had met at some fundraising thing contacted us and said he and his wealthy friends wanted to put on some big fundraiser. And so we worked all together to put on this art exhibition and gala dinner fundraiser, auction fundraiser. And so I got to help with doing the administration behind the art book, collecting the art, getting the art in. So we had members from WAVE who took the art therapy classes to put together art. We had local artists put together some art that were somewhat famous. We had, and then Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst, who are apparently massive names in the art world, they contributed art. Jimmy got his agents on board, and they contacted celebrities. So that's how I got the Andy Serkis portrait painting. Maeve Binchy contributed. Jude Law traced his arm. That sold for a few thousand pounds. William Hurt contributed. Joan Rivers. Just like there was like 20 or 30 wow. artists, like celebrities who donated. Bono from U2 contributed something. Mm-hmm. And then the next, so we had the art exhibition where people could just buy the art, and then we auctioned art off as well. And then we had a gala dinner, and some designers donated like designer handbags and jewelry and water for crystal and experiences like spend a day at the racetrack or whatever. And it was just phenomenal to be there and to raise the money that helped them stay open. And it's been a long time since I've been there, but to see what they're doing these days, it's just amazing to see all the supports that they're able to give people and to know that we help keep their doors open to be able to grow into what they are. My little part made it a difference. A little bit. Yeah. And but the people are just incredible, and I miss them all the time. Ellen McBride, who I gave a shout out to, his wife had been and mother and no not his mother-in-law, she was still there. She was Elsie. She was one of my volunteer ladies. Elsie and her wee buns. No, his wife, her daughter had, and her Elsie's husband, his father-in-law, they'd owned a fish market on the Shankill Road, which is in the Protestant side of West Belfast, that had been blown up by the Irish Republican Army and killed. So they were killed. And yet he's there working with people from both sides when he could so easily have been filled with hate to bring about healing for the community. And so many stories like that, so many heartbreaking stories, and then you see them come out the other side, and it's just, oh, so amazing. And I miss it. I love the people. There was just nothing like it.
Do you ever see yourself going back?
I would love to go back. So much has changed. I was reading the book. Well, it starts with Bread Boy by Tony McCauley, who's a Northern Ireland Irish writer. And he's been working towards getting rid of the peace lines, which are these massive walls that divided the communities that they put up. And so they don't have so on the street that I lived, it was in Protestant side of West Belfast. And we had the big gate at the end of the road that divided us. There was a pass through pedestrian gate that was open usually, but the big driving gate, the big green gate, was always closed. That's gone now. I believe there's a glass gate there now. I don't know if that makes it much different, but so much has changed. So much has changed. I would love to go back and see it again. I don't have any immediate plans to go back. Probably not for a few more years, but it's always in the back of my mind, how am I going to get back there?
All right. Well, I'm going to take the show back.
Okay.
Before we talk about...
yeah, because I could keep asking questions and commenting and whatnot, but...
She'll never stop. I will say this, though. When we went to... So we went to... not Northern Ireland, Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Dublin, and we went across the countryside to Galway and stuff. And the one thing about Ireland is... Nicest people. Everyone is so friendly. It is unreal.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even the drunks in the street who are being loud, and you're like, oh, that's trouble. And then you just want to just give you a hug or something, right? Like, everybody's so nice.
Yep. They really, really are. And they just have a natural gift for storytelling and for humor. I don't know. So I went to the Writers Museum that they have there. That was in James Joyce's house.
Mm-hmm.
George Bernard Shaw's home is now a hotel. So I stayed there. I kissed the Blarney Stone. I'm like, when is this going to start coming in? Like, I'm still waiting for the magic to rub off on me.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we did it. It was like just like a writer's tour. We went and hit everything we could that had something to do with writing.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, last question, not Ireland related.
Oh.
What's your, you can do one or two here or more if you want, whatever. What's your advice for the budding author? You can do craft, you can do business, you can do all of the above.
I'm going to say this, believe in yourself. And even in the hard times, you have a story that needs to be told. Otherwise, it wouldn't keep pestering you. So write it. Nobody has to see it until you're ready to. That is the beautiful thing about writing. So let the first draft be absolute crap, because it can be, because nobody has to see it. Nobody who's published their first draft. I promise you, it went through at least 20 million edits before it got done. So believe in yourself and surround yourself with people who believe in you. It's okay, you know, if they're giving you feedback and critique group, but that they're doing that to help you because they believe in you, that you can do it. And of course, I'm always a coach, so you can always talk to me too. I'm also going to say just start. One word, one sentence, one paragraph at a time. And that's not just for the budding author. I sit down to an empty page of my... Actually, when I stop writing a chapter, I start the next chapter with just writing like the chapter number so that I'm not looking at a blank page when I start the next day. And I will also put in there, you know, just start, so that I'm reminded that I don't have to overthink it. I can just write something and I could, because I can always fix it later.
Right.
And in terms of the business, you have options. And I was saying to Phil before we started that that's what I love about this podcast, is that you guys talk about both traditional and self-publishing, because you can do both at the same time, or one or the other, and you don't have to pick. So that's my advice.
Well, nice. Thank you. I loved it. That was great advice. And I appreciate the compliment for the show. Do you know, there is one thing I was thinking about when you were talking about the blank page that I did recently that I think I didn't even realize helps. But so I used Scrivener, right? Yep. And so I just made like a little template, and so I got like my chapter up at the top, and then I've got my typeset or whatever. So my first line says blah and my second line says blah blah, and I just hit copy it. I just like duplicate it every time I'm going to start a new chapter, but now it's not blank and it's like, well, I can do better than blah blah blah, you know.
Exactly. Just remember to take those blah blah blahs out later.
That's right.
Yeah, delete them at some point in the process.
It's just fine if I forget them. JH will strategically remove them.
I will.
All right, let's do the
news.
I was
going to say, I also had a thought when you're talking about no one's published their first drafts, and I was just thinking in my head, like, well, actually, in today's world with people using AI, I'm pretty sure some of those are first drafts that are out in the world right now. I don't know if those count.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's altogether possible. I guess I'm thinking, like, so many writers I talk to, they're like, oh, well, Patricia McKillop did this. I'm like, yeah, but do you know how many editors saw that
Patricia
first?
Patricia McKillop's amazing.
You know how, do you know how long she's been doing this? Like, don't compare your beginning, even if you've been at writing for a long time, but if you haven't been published yet, like, don't compare your beginning, which is where you're at, to someone else's middle/ later in their career.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have no shame. Like, my first drafts look like they were written by a 5-year-old hopped up on Mountain Dew. Yep. Like, they're a mess.
Yeah.
You know, but it's fine. You just have to get it done, right? You can't fix it if it's not there.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you write a first draft and you've gone through with Grammarly or you're editing as you go, that's not a first draft.
Yeah.
Because you've already made some changes to it. I consider a first draft when you just, like, spew everything onto the page.
Pure brain dump.
Yep.
I agree. All right, cool. Let's do the news. I am so out of practice podcasting that I just hit the record button without telling Sherry or JH that we were going. So here we are. Welcome to the news segment, the first one of the year. And I'm going to fire us off. So Tor, their website, tor.com, is changing its name to Reactor. On January 23rd, tor.com will become Reactor, and the new address will be www.reactormag.com. I don't really understand what's happening here. I don't know why they would disassociate their name from their website. I don't get it, but I think they have a plan. Sounds like they have a plan. They made some statements and they talked about, you know, the magazine aspect of tor.com and sort of being a pop culture hub. So best I can figure, maybe they kind of want to separate that aspect from the book aspect of their publishing. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's interesting news.
Yeah, I saw some comments. I think it might have been in the Sifwood Discord. I can't remember at this point. Or it might have been Superstars. Regardless, they were talking about how it seemed like it was going to be more, like you're talking about, like the pop culture, less of like a literary thing. So they might just be really leaning into that.
Yeah, and making actual tor.com be more about the book side of it, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
I guess we'll see what they do with tor.com after the fact, right?
I also wasn't sure if it was, I mean, obviously the word looks like Reactor, but since their previous name was Tor, in my head it's like, okay, are they trying to play that on like Reactor? Or I don't know.
I don't know, but it's a rocket ship.
It is.
All right, let's do the next news.
I mean, they already had the rocket ship before.
I'm super excited about the next piece of news.
Oh, with Barnes & Noble? Yeah. Yeah, Barnes & Noble planning to open 50 more stores in 2024. CEO claimed they are entering a period of significant growth, which is super exciting.
Yeah, I love Barnes & Noble. So that's, you know, we live out in the middle of nowhere. And when we decide to go into the big city, we either have to go south in the northwest Arkansas, where there's Barnes & Noble, or we have to go north to Joplin. And generally speaking, I prefer to go to Joplin, but Joplin has a Books a Million, which is cool. It's very cool. I like it a lot. I'm not trying to diss it, but it's not Barnes & Noble. Come on.
Speaking for myself, I like both, and I don't care which one. So
shun the non-believer. Barnes & Noble wins. Barnes & Noble smells like coffee and happiness. Books a Million smells like slightly less good coffee and happiness.
No. Probably also, I don't mind because I grew up near Fort Smith, Arkansas, and they had a Books a Million. And I didn't get to go inside until I was either a later teen, I think. I was at least in high school. Because I could remember, like, my parents would drive us, and it was, like, on, like, the main road that goes through the city. And they would always pass it. I never got to go in, and I would, like, just stare at it fondly as we drove by. I finally got to go in later when I was older, but.
See, I think it's the exact opposite for me. When I was a kid, that's where my mom would take me, was to Barnes & Noble. So I have these like really fond memories of going into Barnes & Noble and buying up the Star Wars books and different things, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, so we didn't go there, but my dad loved going to Hastings, and I did too because they had books, but they were also, you know, the movies and the video games and the music and whatnot. So
Hastings could make
I got to go
back.
To that one. Oh, I wish they would. I loved Hastings.
Hastings should return.
I loved that store so much.
All right. So, places with lots of books, but that don't normally sell book. I can't talk. Libraries. Those are places where books are. And it turns out that in 2023, audiobook lens in libraries were up 23% from 2022. This info hails from Overdrive, which is the most popular platform libraries use for lending digital books and audiobooks and things. So they said that audiobook lens were up 23%, ebooks were up 12%, and for all types, like including comics and different things, 19%, which I thought was interesting. I think we talked about a while back that library usage was actually up. And so I guess it's kind of interesting to see the digital side of that growing as well, right? I hope that sound that I just heard did not come over my speaker or over my microphone.
I don't know.
Oh,
I feel like I heard it as well, but I don't know if I heard it through the computer or in real life.
I didn't hear anything, though.
Okay. Lovely. Wonderful. Thank you for confirming that. Onward and upward?
Yeah, the next bit. January 1st was Public Domain Day, so copyrighted works from 1928 joined the public domain on the 1st. Titles include The House at Pooh Corner, which is a Winnie the Pooh book by A.M. Milne, and Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie, as well as thousands of other books. Which reminds me, and this isn't necessarily related to the copyright part, but so Phil knows I'm part of a Tolkien group that's kind of situated around the Prancing Pony podcast, which is a really wonderful Tolkien podcast that if you're a Tolkien fan, you should definitely check it out. One of the members, Jordan Rennells, he had done a soundscape for The Lord of the Rings, and I think he's working on one for The Silmarillion, but he just released one for Winnie the Pooh with former Prancing Pony podcast host Sean Marchese. So definitely check those out if you like Winnie the Pooh, Lord of the Rings, or soundscapes. And for those who don't know, a soundscape is kind of like music and ambiance stuff that goes along with reading the book. So it's supposed to be at the pace you're reading the books that the sounds are happening, which is really cool.
Interesting.
That's really intriguing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't know that that was a thing. I guess now I do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually got to for Tolkien Reading Day last year. They did like a snippet of it, and they had people from our community who volunteered to read chapters from Lord of the Rings. And one that stuck out to me, they did, in the House of Tom Bombadil. And so, you know, they had the person reading. And for a visual, there's another group called Artocraft, who basically created Middle Earth in Minecraft. And it's just this massive ongoing thing. So you had someone running around in Artocraft at the House of Tom Bombadil, someone reading it, and you had the soundscape playing that makes it sound like you're there. And it was super cool.
Wow.
That is cool. All right. Our next story comes from Wattpad. So Wattpad did a bunch of reader research, and they have a bazillion statistics on here. But as an author, there was just a few that I plucked out that I thought were really interesting. So, and I guess, you know, this would be based on people who use Wattpad, right? So one of the interesting statistics that they showed was 92% of readers believe that humans should be involved in writing books. So put a check mark beside that. That's a win for authors and people who are worried about AI. There are a lot of people, by and large, I think most readers today, that might not be true in 50 years, but today most readers aren't as interested in reading books by robots. They want to read books by humans. So that was a good one. And then also I thought was interesting, not necessarily surprising, but it is worth noting if you're an author and you haven't thought about it before, is that their statistics showed that younger generations are more likely to lean into the digital formats. This would be important for you to know as part of your target audience, right? So if you're trying to define who that target audience is and you're thinking about their age and, you know, most likely you're planning to do your book in every format, but it might change how you market and approach things to just know that, right? The other one that I thought was interesting, probably the most intriguing to me as a writer, is that most of the people, you know, that they were looking at said they preferred book recommendations from other humans. That was true across every generation. But 68% of millennials and 72% of Gen Z indicated that they also look for book suggestions from BookTok and BookTube, which is a pretty staggering. I mean, I don't know how many people that they actually, you know, polled or researched or how they did this, but that's a staggeringly high number.
Yeah. It's funny because we were just in the bookstore this past weekend, Books a Million, by the way, and there were two young women like in the same aisles around me, and they were looking for a book they'd seen on BookTok.
Oh, that's funny. Do you know what was also funny about our trip to Books a Million? This is a true story. We got out of the car and we were walking in and some dude came out and he was wearing like old school JNCOs, you know, like the super big pants and like a little top hat or something. And he was singing, but like screaming his song at the top of his lungs just as he was walking through the parking lot.
Yep.
Was there a song about books at least?
No.
Honestly, no. I don't know what he was talking about. I don't know what he was singing about. He was like singing death metal. It was, you're not far off. It was like, he was screaming like death metal, you know? Like why, who doesn't,
about that.
Yeah, who doesn't walk out of the bookstore singing death metal at the top of their lungs for everyone to hear? I'm such a country bumpkin. I was like, I just looked at JH and I was like, ugh, the city. all right. JH, are you doing the voice or am I doing the voice?
Is it your turn?
I don't know. We miss you, Christopher. All right, I'm going to do it. In our continued coverage of our robot overlords.
So this first piece of news, I guess technically comes from China. An AI-generated novel won second place in a competition in China, I guess. But it was an AI-generated novel called Land of Memories. It's credited to Shen Yang, but I'm not going to say by Shen Yang, because if they're using AI to generate it, then I say you didn't really write it, did you? But regardless, they didn't ban AI from the competition, and it got second place.
Yeah, I put your name beside this one because I knew it would irritate you. That's why I selected you. I knew you would give this story with all of the venom. Yeah, so... Well, I guess this goes to show, like, I have a very unpopular opinion, and I know it's unpopular, but unfortunately I spent a few years working in software development, and a lot of people are like, the AI won't ever be able to compete with us. Like, I don't think that that's true, unfortunately. I think the AI will be able to develop a voice. I think it will be able to compete with us. That said, for me, it changes nothing, right? Like, I am a writer. It's part of who I am. It's never going to change, right? If the world ended and I was living alone in the apocalypse, I would still be looking for good sheets of paper I could scribble stories on. It is what it is, right? And I think that, you know, we saw that in that statistic from Wattpad that 92% of readers think that humans should be involved in writing books. And I think that that will remain true, at least in our lifetime, that most people will want books written by people and not robots. So I'm not scared of it. I do think it will get as good as people. It might even get better than a lot of people. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. I want to read books by people. I want to write books. And hopefully there are people who want to read my books. So, all right. Also on the AI front, The New York Times has raised a suit against OpenAI and Microsoft. They are claiming, surprise, surprise, that OpenAI and Microsoft used their intellectual property to train AI without their permission. Shocking that this is like the 80th of these we've seen and talked about on the show. And I'm just going to go ahead and say, I'm going to throw my lot in with the New York Times and everyone else. I think that that's a fair argument. Like, the AI companies are just taking books and feeding it to their AI and then using it to create their own stuff. Like, that's not okay. That is stealing, right? At the very least, they should be paying to eat up that IP, right? So it's the same as if somebody was like, oh, well, I like this Blade Mage book, but this Philip Dreyer Duncan idiot wrote, I'm going to go make a movie out of it. And then they just go do it. And they go build something new off of what I created. How's that different from somebody doing it through software?
Yep. I was going to add with the comment about they should be paying for it. That's with the caveat that the author even agrees to it. Because some may be like, I don't care what amount of money you want to throw at me. You're not allowed to use my stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, true story, right? It is more than just paying. It's having an agreement with the author. You're using their copyright to build. You're using their intellectual property to build something. And for whatever reason, like, all the big tech companies are just like, ah, no, we're allowed to do it. You published it. So therefore it is ours. We can eat it and use it and do whatever we want. You know?
No.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's your news.
All right, for our tool section this time, Sherry's going to tell us all about the Remarkable.
Really? You're not even going to you're going to pretend like something bad happened?
No.
I mean, if you want to.
All right. I like to own our mistakes. I think it makes the podcast more fun. We're actually not even recording this the same day we recorded the rest of the podcast because we had technical difficulties.
I broke the recording system.
Sherry straight up broke our record. We had these really great files where it was just Jessica and I staring at the screen awkwardly and then responding to no one.
And I'm just yammering.
It was fun. Yeah. Sherry was a ghost.
Yep.
So we're doing it again.
Okay. All right. So the Remarkable is the best writing tool I have ever come across. It is my dream machine. It allows you to convert handwriting to type text, like pages and pages and pages at a time. I've tried a number of different things because I love to write longhand. And so retyping everything takes for forever. And I know people say, oh, I edit as I retype. But when you've written a whole 90,000 word novel in notebooks, retyping it, I'm not taking my time to edit as I go. I get too tired of it. I just want to type it all in, but it takes weeks. And so I was always looking for some way to be able to convert my handwriting. So first thing I tried was called a Live Scribe. It's a digital pen that takes a picture of your handwriting and uploads it, which I guess is great for meeting notes or something, but it didn't really do it with handwriting. It would convert the handwriting one line at a time and convert that into individual PDF files. So, you know, if I have written a page, you know, a nice 8.5 by 11 sheet page full, you know, that's like 30 PDF files. I'm not spending my time copying and pasting that. And then I found the Remarkable online. And at that time, it didn't do the handwriting conversion yet. So I was like, okay, just wait. And finally, I think it was about a year later, they started advertising that you could convert your handwriting. And I know they also, you know, suggest it's for business, for making notes and sharing graphics and stuff like that. But, you know, I waited. One or two people posted that the handwriting conversion worked fairly well. So then I just had to get it. So, and I found that it was, you know, really easy. It's easy on the eyes because it's the e-ink screen. And so, you know, when it feels nice, you kind of get that scratchy feeling of the pencil on the paper, pen on paper. And I could just go for pages at a time. And it converts my handwriting at about 95%. And my handwriting is atrocious. Always has been, but it's gotten worse. And it still does a very reasonable job. So then, I mean, there's still some editing I have to do because it recognizes my R's as S's. So I'll often have to go back and change that. But, you know, that's okay. I don't have to spend, you know, 7 weeks typing in first, then to go back and fix. And that's just typos. So that's fine. And I've also tried the Kobo Ellipsis, which also has the ink screen, but it has backlighting, but the pen needs batteries, and I had to press really hard to write on it, and it was just so unnatural. So I love my Remarkable. I've upgraded to the Remarkable 2, and they've now added the Type Folio, which I must say changed everything, because not only now can I handwrite, if I decide that I'm feeling more creative by typing, I just turn the page, flip the Remarkable on its side, connect to the keyboard that is part of the folio, the holder that it comes in, and I start typing, and I just pick up where I left off. Same document.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Nice. So I can convert then my handwriting into the type text, copy and paste that into what I've already written with the typing, and away I go. Pages, chapters at a time. I can just, if I start typing and I feel blocked and I switch over to the handwriting, then I just, again, turn it onto its side. I go back to my handwriting and pick up where I left off. And I don't have to worry. And because it syncs up to your computer, so you don't have to worry about, you know, did you miss something? Because you still have access to your handwriting as well. So, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, copying, pasting one thing into your Word document, your Scrivener, and then finding the other part, it's all right there for you. Oh, it's so life-changing. It's so portable. I can take it anywhere. And I love the pen. It's got a little magnet on the back, so you just, you know, you can flip it over and just erase stuff. Little hint, though, is kind of expensive, so don't let your dog near it because it won't determine if that's a stick or a pen, and it'll chew it up. Also, it is magnetic. It is supposed to stick to the Remarkable. I find, though, that I tend to just leave it places, so now I have to purposely keep putting it back in its little box. Otherwise, you know, you might get left at, you know, a restaurant when I've been writing. So it's also getting expensive to replace, but, you know, you can take it anywhere, and it is super light. It just fits in my purse, and I go. I mean, laptops are great. They're nice and portable. I've heard a lot of people can do the same thing with an iPad, but I love this because it doesn't have that backlighting. You're not looking at that harsh blue light all the time. Because I spend my days looking at the computer, so I don't want to spend all my time in the evenings or on my breaks doing that. And again, because it syncs at work, I can also then open Syncs on the computers at work. You know, I'm sitting at my computer at work and I have a little bit of quote unquote downtime. I can just pop open the Remarkable app on my computer. It's all synced up and I just start typing where I left off. And then I go for my lunch break with my Remarkable and there it is again. And it's just, it's the most perfect machine I've ever experienced. They even interviewed me about how I use the Remarkable as a writer. And, you know, they were saying, well, because I'm such an evangelist for it. And they're saying, well, have you talked to our PR department? And I said, no, I am your PR department. I think everybody should have it. And I think everybody should be able to use it. I mean, I know it's expensive, but I do have an affiliate link. I don't actually get any kickback from it, but it does give you a discount. So I'll send that to you guys if you want to let me know. But the one drawback is, now I've been grandfathered in because I had the first one. But they now you do have to pay, I think it's $7 or $8 a month to have their Connect subscription. So that is, I think that's, you know, for the converting of the type text and for better storage and connects you to Google Drive and Dropbox and stuff, which it didn't do that before.
That's not bad, really. I mean, if you use it a lot,
yeah,
it's pretty reasonable.
I mean, I use it for work. I use it for writing. I use it for coaching. I use it for everything. So, yeah, I cannot recommend it enough.
I got to play with one a little bit, and one of the things I really liked was the, how would you say it, the texture of the device itself. Yep. It doesn't feel like you're writing on glass.
Yeah,
it's got a little bit of a little bit of a trampoline thing to it, kind of stepping in mud a little bit. Like, it's got some... Yep. I can't think of what I want to say. It's got some input, right? Yep. It feels a little bit more like paper than writing on a screen.
Yeah.
And I was impressed with how accurate it was because my handwriting is pretty atrocious as well. Yep. And I wrote a few paragraphs it was my buddies. I just yanked it out of his hands and was like, I need to play with this.
Yeah.
And you know, I wrote a few paragraphs and it got most of it right. And then I ran away with his device so that Jessica could play with it too. And I think it got most of hers pretty accurate as well. I think it's something that's definitely on my to acquire list. I was looking, I know the Zon's trying to compete with them now with their scribe, but I don't know how they match up, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I also like that I'm not a lefty, but my brother is a lefty. And I remember seeing him trying to write with his, you know, hand all like, so you can avoid the ink smears. And this is left-handed friendly. You can adjust the controls so that it works for left-handed people.
Yeah, that is neat.
Yeah, I had a coaching client who used a Supernote, which I think worked sort of familiar or similar, but she was not as happy with it. I don't think it does nearly as well a conversion as the Remarkable. I don't know.
The conversion's key, right?
Conversion is key. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be
And they'll get better. I mean, it's only going to get better from here, right? It's just like, you know, we've talked about Dragon a few times. And
yes.
I know over the years people have had, you know, I've talked to people who've had varying levels of annoyance on how accurate it was. But like where it's at now, like the phone version they have now is so much more accurate than what I had 10 years ago when I bought the software, you know? Yeah. So, and those things are only going to continue to get better, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And I think too, like Dragon, cause it would learn with your, as you used it, you know, the more you spoke into it, the better its translation got. And I think to an extent, the Remarkable works the same way, you know, as it gets you your handwriting. But I'm shocked still sometimes at how accurate it is, considering how terrible my handwriting is. I mean, I think my printing is neater, but it does better with my handwriting, my cursive.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. But I love it because it allows me to feel that creative flow that I get when I write longhand. Because that is my natural, I mean, that's how I started writing personal computers as a kid. Well, even older. But, you know, you'd spend nights sitting on your bed writing in your notebook when you're supposed to be sleeping instead of, you know, sleeping. And so I just used to writing longhand, and there's something more natural about that flow from brain to pen and paper. And so I love that with the Remarkable. And then I can always switch over if I want to now with the Typefolio.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if I'm a baby about my wrist. So it'd be nice if if it allowed you like a Bluetooth keyboard input. I don't know if that's a thing or not, but that would be nice to be able to
not yet
hit it with my Ergo.
But I do feel that I am kind of, I don't know if it's ironic because I love my Remarkable. But I had carpal tunnel about 25 years ago and a little more than that now, but it was atrocious. It was like the worst time of my life. And so I tend to be very particular about needing a Bluetooth keyboard ergonomic keyboard. And I just bought myself a new one over Christmas because my little portable one has died. And so I actually opened up the Remarkable app on my laptop, plugged into my Bluetooth new ergonomic keyboard, and I kept typing. So I could still work on my novel in there and then take
it. Oh, yeah, got you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I guess that would work. Yeah, that would work for me too. Because in reality, now that I'm thinking about it, I've got this little MacBook Air that I always take everywhere with me because it's super lightweight. So if I was wanting to type, I would just go to that anyway. You know? Yeah, that seems to work. I want to get one. I'll get one at some point in the near future.
Don't use up. Oh, you were going to use up your Amazon points on it.
I did, but I blew my Amazon points on stupid things instead because I forgot. I was sick and I forgot. Stupid things
being action figures.
I bought myself toys. Guys, listen, I talked about it before Christmas, and then JH, by the way, I got my last Christmas present from somebody last night, and it was an Ewok action figure. So,
oh, you didn't tell me that.
Yeah, some people heard me on this action figure thing. But then when I was sick, I was laying here and I was like, I want toys. And I want to, you know, so then I just was like, I'm not going to waste money on that. And then I was like, well, I have Monopoly money. I have Amazon money I've built up. And then I did. And then they got here And I'm going to be honest, I didn't have the sense of excitement I thought I would have, because it was just like, well, now I just got a bunch of crap. I would have been better off with a remarkable. I mean, this Gandalf who's looking at me from the corner is pretty cool. But they're not as cool as the ones JH got me.
Are they still in the package?
No, I ripped them out. Oh. I'm not cute. Ripped them right out of the package. These are to play. This is for a grown man to play with.
Okay, well then you're going to play with them then.
Speaking of which, you know, when you were talking about writing as a kid, like, so that was one of my moves. I would like go into my room, and if it was like a nice day, I'd go into my room and I'd be like, because, you know, my mom or my dad would be like, you should be outside. It's a nice day, right?
Yep.
And I go, all right. So I go into my room and I'd be like, okay, what do we want to do here? I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a Spider-Man story today. All right. So I need my Spider-Man, and which bad guys is, you know, is anybody coming in? And I'd have this little bucket and I'd fill it with action figures. And then I would take my little bucket and a pen and a notepad, and I'd go sit on my trampoline and I would use my action figures to work out these storylines. Cool. And I would write them out.
That's fun.
Yeah, I remember one of my friends came over one time and was like, let's play with these action figures. And I was like, all right, we'll need a notebook. And he was like, what? What is wrong with you? And of course, he was like the kid who like smashed the action figures together. And I was just like, this doesn't work for me. No. I want a divorce. You know?
No.
Like, that's not how you... No. I was never an action figure smasher. It was all like very meticulously planned movements and stuff, you know?
Well, you know, that's how writers still work on their action scenes.
Is it? I should go back to that. I need a big bucket of G.I. Joes.
Well, I guess we do it with, you know, those articulating figures you can buy at like Michael's?
Those
little wooden people. So you can actually see how the body would work and move and stuff like that, so that, you know, they're not fighting with two right arms.
I actually bought one of those for that purpose, but then I never used it. I don't know, once I get into the action scene flow state, I don't really need any visuals, to be honest, at this point. But most of them, like almost all of my big battle scenes, which is kind of the thing I guess I'm known for a little bit, is, you know, people always comment on my crazy, outlandish, over-the-top battle scenes. But I just, almost 100% of those are written by hand.
Yep. Well, and you have the experience writing with your action figures all those years.
Right. So
it's second nature now.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I guess that will be our tool segment.
Yay.
Woohoo! All right, so to kick off the new year, I thought it would be fun for Creatives on Fire to sort of maybe put a little bit more structure around it, and just kind of have like, kind of maybe take it from the beginning. It's a new year. We can kind of start over and go through things. Maybe some of our thoughts and opinions have changed on different things. But I did like, in the latter part of last year, we were basically every episode doing one piece that was sort of more around financial independence, and then one piece that was sort of more around the business of being an author. So I want to stick to that, but kind of take both from the top again and sort of have a little bit of a plan on what to cover. So with that in mind, I'll start with the financial independence side of it. And I know, like, in the very first or second episode, I went into way, way off the rails on this. And then also episode 7, we kind of covered everything in one big episode. But I just want to touch back again to, like, why the financial independence thing was important to me and why I wanted to include it on the show. And that just goes back to, you know, I wanted to be a writer since I was a kid. In fact, I can remember, you know, like one of the first moments where I was like, this is what I want to be when I grow up. And unfortunately, I had to pursue adulty things, boring, gross, and have day jobs and such. And that whole time I was always like, I have to write books. I have to make this happen. I have to somehow become a bestseller, because if you're not, you know, like in a, not in, you have to be more than a bestseller in today's world. You have to be, you know, I heard a statistic once, and I don't know if it's accurate, but I'm willing to bet it's pretty dang close. And the statistic was that if you walked into a major bookstore, you know, a Barnes & Noble or a Books A Million, and you looked at all the authors on those shelves, only 6% of them could make enough money to make a living, right? And those are the ones who've gotten past the gatekeepers. Those are the ones who were able to sell a book to a publisher and or get an agent to go sell their books, right? And then on the self-publishing side, that's very challenging as well, right? So to me, it was like, okay, well, you have to do that, right? You have to win the lottery to be able to do this thing you want to do full time. And it was when I stumbled across, you know, the financial independence and the retire early crowd and what they were trying to accomplish that I went, it was kind of a light bulb moment. It was like, actually, this is a different way. It's longer and it's slower, but it's probably less painful. And I can do this. Like, I can pursue this route and find a way to buy my freedom. And so that's where I started learning about the investing and the saving and value-based spending, like not blowing all your Amazon points on action figures that you're never going to do anything with. That I really started down this path. And, you know, every time I get paid, I'm that much closer to it, right? Every time JH gets paid, she's that much closer to it. And yeah, it's a slow burn. It's a slow way to get there, but it's a second option. And that to me was life changing, right? I don't just have to achieve it by winning the lottery. I can also achieve it by a slow, methodical approach to my finances and using that Trinity study 4% rule and all of those things. For me, I just can't say enough about it and what a life-changing realization it was. And I won't rail on it more than that. If you want to hear me rail more on it, then you could go back to episode 1, where I won't be slamming my keyboard around while I'm recording. So unprofessional. If Chris was here right now, he'd be so disappointed.
I'll be disappointed for him.
Thank you, Sherry. Yes. He'll appreciate that. JH, do you have anything to add on that? Or Sherry, either one.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because I know we've talked about it before, but yeah, basically when you first came across that and were talking to me about it, I kind of had the same thought, like, okay, this is another thing I can do that can help me get to my goal, which is to just be able to write full time, work on my books, and not have to worry about, you know, going into a day job every day and, you know, for, you know, the majority of my life. So I just wish that you discovered it a little bit sooner so that I could be further along that path. Yeah, that would have been nice. But yeah, we might have already gotten to the point we need to be at if you'd done that. But oh well, we're getting there now.
Better late than never. We're on our way. We're doing all right.
Can I just say that I appreciate the realistic approach. Mm-hmm. So many writers that I've met who are just starting out think that their first book is going to be a blockbuster bestseller and they're going to quit their job as soon as they get an agent. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, for 99.999%, there's always that 0.001% that mm-hmm. happens for. They're the outliers, that the exceptions that prove the rule. But for the vast majority of us, that doesn't happen. And even those who are in that 6% that can now make a living from their writing, they weren't able to from their first book, most likely. Again, there's the outlier that could, but for the most part, that doesn't happen. And so, you know, you need to take that independent and that freedom that we all want to be able to pursue our writing. You have to come at it with a different perspective.
Yeah, I think that's really important. It's really key to understand that, because that reality can come down real hard if you're not prepared for it. I know the first publisher I worked with was a smaller press, and I remember the publisher telling me, being very adamant, like, listen, we're going to do this and hopefully we're going to get some sales. We're going to, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, but need to be very realistic about it. Like, you know, this is like a, you know, at the end of the day, you might make enough to get a nice steak dinner. And the reason they were so adamant about it was because they actually had an author that they agreed to publish their novel. And I think they were having some kind of conversation about the timelines or whatever. And the author was like, oh, don't worry, I'll have that second book done super quick or whatever since I quit my job. And they were like, what? No. Oh, no. Right. But even the other side of it, too, though, is even if you are successful, understanding, having a base knowledge and how savings work and investments work and how to manage your finances mm-hmm. is going to save you money in the long term. And then the other side of it, too, is while you're on that path, you come to a place where now, like, you know, as J.H. alluded to, like, we're not there yet, but we're also way more prepared for bad news to hit than we were 5 years ago, mm-hmm. than we were 3 years ago, right? So, mm-hmm. I think it's a key thing that people should take more seriously. I really do.
I think you also have to take into account like all the things you don't really think about when you've got a day job. So it's like, okay, say you get the agent, you get a publishing contract. It may even be for a decent amount of money, but it's like you still have to pay taxes on that. That amount's now covering all your bills for the year if you don't get any other contracts that year. Sometimes they may not pay you the entire amount until like you'll have like deliverables that are due, like, you know, you have this due in 6 months and this other thing due a year from now, you know, that sort of thing. And they'll pay out small increments.
Yep. It's split into 2, 3, 4 payments over 2, 3 years.
Right. And then you also have health insurance. Yeah. And you also have health insurance you have to cover now on your own. That's not through a day job. So you have to figure that piece out. So there's lots more to consider.
And 15% goes to the agent.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yep.
True story.
Yeah.
All right. Then to flip the coin and to talk about the business side of it, and Sherry's lovely compliment for the show earlier fits right in with what that topic is. And that is that, again, something we talked about in one of the very early episodes, and I just want to highlight it again. Based on, you know, my experience with the industry, what I've seen, what I know, where it's at today, there are two realistic paths to building your author career. And that is to go the traditional route and get an agent and get them to sell to a major publisher, or somehow sell to a major publisher yourself, either or on that. And then, you know, you go through that traditional route where it sells in Barnes and Noble and Books a Million and hopefully sells enough that they want to continue working with you and continue publishing your work. And you hit the New York Times bestseller list and all your dreams come true. Right. So that's one path. And, you know, and that's obviously a very challenging path that a very select few of people succeed with. The other path is via the, you know, some people call it indie, some people call it self-publishing, and it's to go that route where you're in control of everything and you're doing everything. And then specifically, you know, following the tenets of the people who have done it really successfully, because there are a few things that they do, and they do them very well, right? So they make sure that they have highly professional covers. They make sure that they know all about the keywords. They learn all about that side of the business, how to use the right keywords, use the right categories. They make sure that their cover is not only phenomenal, but it matches the genre and the market that they're in. They typically will do like a rapid release schedule where they have a whole lot of books done up. And they release them, you know, a month apart or 3 months apart to make the most of the Amazon algorithms, and they learn how to spend money on ads to get their books to sell. Right. And that's really important to point out, because I think a lot of people get it in their mind. They're like, well, the traditional route is so hard, I'll go this route and it'll work because there won't be a gatekeeper to tell me that I can't publish this. Right. But unfortunately, unless they really understand, unless you really put in the time to learn and understand what you're doing, it's going to be just as challenging, if not harder. And the exciting part is that nobody tells you that you can't do both.
Yes.
But do both well.
Agreed.
So we'll go into more detail later on, you know, strategies around both of those things. I'm not here to advocate for trad or indie. As we've talked about a lot, JH and I are both kind of pursuing both paths. I've certainly myself personally at this point have had more success on the indie side, but that doesn't mean that I'm all in there either. I want to pursue both and whatever works, right?
Yep. Speaking of, kind of going off on a tangent for a second, but since he's not going to mention it, I want to throw... Don't you start laughing. Wanted to bring some light to Phil for a second, because recently, talking about the, you know, Amazon and best-selling stuff, Phil is now a best-selling author.
That is Woo-hoo! True.
Yeah.
As of Christmas morning.
I don't
know
how much you want to share about that, so yeah.
Well, I didn't say anything because I was on the fence about how much I did want to say. But yeah, on Christmas Day of all days, I became an international best-selling Amazon author, I guess is how you'd say it. I'm just going to say international best-selling author because I'm gonna take it. I did. I took number one in a category on Christmas Day. I held that till some point in the next day, and I slid back a little bit. And then a few days later, I took a number one spot in a U.S. category as well and held that for a day or so. So I'm not super rich or famous yet, but it felt really good to see that. I've really been thinking about how to talk about it on the podcast because I feel like it's dangerous ground. Like I don't really, it's not like I don't want to hide anything. I want to be helpful, but I also want to be careful. I don't want somebody to go, oh, I'm going to go do what he did exactly. Because part of that involved, I've been spending some time over the last couple months learning, how to do the AMS ads and some of the other ad platforms and kind of figuring that out. And this was very much a result of doing that. So I just want to be careful what I say, because I don't want somebody to be like, oh, well, he did it. I'm going to go do the same thing. And then they go throw a bunch of money into something and it doesn't work. I really spent a lot of time researching and studying. What I would say, I think that I would feel comfortable telling somebody is, AMS ads are a good place to start, and you can sort of start toying with them without having to worry about spending too much money, because the Amazon ad platform is the one ad platform out there that like kind of actively tries to not spend your money. It's very peculiar.
It really does.
Yeah. It was really hard to get it to actually spend your money.
Can you at least spend a dollar, please?
Could you do something?
Could you? Yeah. Can I ask you a question, though?
Yeah.
Does Amazon let you know that you've reached number one, or are you like checking your Author Central page?
No, I was checking my Author Central page like a psycho all day, just refreshing.
Yes. And was it, and again, because of the nature, you don't necessarily have to answer, is it because you had just started, or you were doing the ads and you were seeing how it was tracking? Is that why you were checking? Or is this your hourly habit that you just naturally every hour check your Author Central page, regardless of what you're doing?
No, what I did just curious, was...
Because I forget that I have an Author Central page. Yep.
No, I'll give a little bit more without trying to, because I really just want to be careful that somebody doesn't try to follow exactly in my footsteps. I want to be cautious to the general public that I don't give too much, that somebody goes and does something dangerous without doing the work I did on the first side to learn. So what I did was I knew that in my Blade Mage series, it's been a couple of years since I put any new ones out, and I had one, I have one about ready. JH is editing it, and I actually finished two nights ago the next one. So I know I was going to have two that I'm probably going to try to get out this year. And I thought, well, one of the things I haven't spent the time to learn is how to do some of the ad stuff like I want to. I've done some of the things in the past, like the countdown deals and things like that. And so I thought, well, I know I'm not going to get the book out soon. Like it's not going to be before the end of the year. So but does it make sense to go ahead and start trying to figure some of this out ahead of time before the new ones come out? So if I can actually breathe some life into a book series that hasn't been had anything in the last couple years, that'd be a pretty good sign that I'm figuring it out. And then maybe I'll have more success when, you know, I get the new ones out. So I started with pure and simple. I was like, well, I'll do a countdown deal. and I'll use some of the Countdown Deal sites that are said to be very reputable. And it just so happened that the big one I wanted, they approved me, but the only slot they had available was Christmas Day. And I was like, well, I'm about to throw a bunch of money in the dumpster because I'm not going to back out of it now. Like, I got to take that day, right? So I set up the Countdown Deal for that day, for Christmas Day. And then I was able to get some of the other reputable but cheaper ones tied in throughout the rest of the week because I ran the whole week-long Countdown Deal. And then what I did was I started from there with AMS. Once I had all that set up, I'd done that before, so that part wasn't weird. AMS I messed with a little bit in the past, but I didn't really dive in. And the resource I think that I found the most helpful, actually there were two, and I'm happy to share what those were. One is David Godren.
Yep.
He has, if you go to his, he's got a wonderful website.
Highly recommend him.
A lot of
him.
Good information. Yeah, highly recommend. He also has a YouTube channel where he walks you through how to set up different ads and things and how what to think about, what to look at. And then I also, there's an author named M.A. Rothman. And he did, we got a train coming. I'm ignoring that train. I'm cutting that train out. There's an author named M.A. Rothman. Oh. And he spoke at 20 Books Vegas. He did two parts on Facebook ads that really helped provide – or not Facebook ads, I'm sorry, AMS ads that really provided the context for me that I needed to actually start tinkering with them and getting them to – it was really – that's the piece, right? You go in there, you read most of the advice, you watch a video, and you go set it up. And you're like, that's kind of a how-to to set it up. But then nothing really happens, you know?
Yeah.
Or when you finally get it to spend 20 bucks, you just – like, that's it. You sold one book and you're like, and so some of what he talked about, and you can see those on the 20 Books Vegas YouTube channel. They're up free to go watch. He provided the missing context I needed to get the Amazon AMS ads to get going a little bit.
Yeah.
And what I learned was I went to a different platform, and this one's more dangerous, so I'm not going to say what it was. I went and learned a different platform. I know I slipped and said Facebook earlier. It was not Facebook. I'm ignoring you, train. You're not there. I went to a different platform and spent some time learning a whole different platform. That platform returned an immediate result in sales. And as soon as that happened, the AMS ads fired to life. And instead of showing a few hundred, they started showing thousands of impressions. And then those impressions started converting like fire.
Yeah.
So from right there, I stopped and I said, okay, I know what I'm going to do on Christmas Day. I'm going to go all out on both of these. I'm going to set my stuff higher and I'm going to risk some money that I can afford to lose because I live very cheaply. And so that's what I did. And it stunned me, Sherry. Like, it fired to life. The AMS ads fired to life. And such a way that even though I'm, it's the 10th now, so the countdown's ended before January 1st, I'm still selling books today. The AMS ads are still trucking along. Good. My three-year-old book is still selling pretty well, and people are buying all the other books in the series and some of my other stuff even. So.
Cool. Because Nicholas Eric is another one who specializes in Amazon ads. So I've been following him because Mabel's coming up on her 10th anniversary this summer. And I want to do some kind of celebrational something with her. And so I'm also looking into the ads and the promotional marketing, which I failed to do the first time around. So
I did it. I just did it all wrong. I don't know which is worse.
Well, I did very little, and I put the second book out a year later, and the third book 2 years after the second one. I wasn't even sure I was going to write the third one for a while. So,
Okay. Well, I think that's a show. Well, this is going to be a super long episode. We've gone way over on time. So, Sherry, tell the peoples where to find you.
You can find me at sherrypeters.com. Sherry, that's S-H-E-R-R-Y, like the drink, as I like to tell people, sherrypeters.com. And from there, you can find me on Instagram, sort of on TikTok and Facebook under various versions of the same Sherry Peters author, I think, on Instagram and TikTok.
And go hire her to be your writing coach.
Yes. Thank you. Please do. I love working with authors. I love working with writers and seeing their progress and falling back in love with the creative process again. So
absolutely.
Best part.
And JH?
You can find me on my website, jhfleming.net. You can also find me on all the social media sites. I now have a Patreon and Ko-fi pages. You can hire me as an editor either through my website or on Fiverr. And then my folk band, Wildwood Minstrels, were on Bandcamp, Spotify, Pandora, all the music sites. Yeah, you can find me at any of those places.
And I am Philip Dreher Duncan. You can find me at philipdreherduncan.com. You can find my books where books be sold. And this has been the first episode of Future Bestseller of 2024. Thank you, Sherry Peters. It was an absolute pleasure. Always enjoy chatting with you.
Yes. Miss you guys.
You too. Mm-hmm. Hire Sherry, guys.
Hire James. Buy Philip's book.
Yes, hire those to buy my books. I like it. I mean, buy their books too, but. And that's a show.